This is the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome to episode number 8 of the Anarchaeologist Podcast. Today I have Tara Copplestone, who is talking to me about archaeology and video games. Yes, I know, we're coming back to archaeology and video games, but there are two parts of my life that I really, really love, I really, really enjoy, and when we bring them together, it just makes me insanely happy. So, Tara, welcome to the show.
Thank you, it's good to be here.
I hope you're well today.
Oh, very well, always well.
Of course. And you run a blog, which is a personal blog, it is blog.taracopplestone.co.uk. If you want to check it out, it'll be in the show notes. So, obviously, your interests are in archaeology and video games. When did that start?
Well, I've been interested in both those things, sort of like disparately, for a long time. I played video games competitively, TF2 and Counter-Strike, and was studying archaeology at the time. And coming into my master's, I sort of started to think, well, why are these two things not really studied or looked at holistically? So, yeah, that's sort of when that interest started to come together in the last sort of 3 years.
And I mean, did you, obviously, for people like myself and yourself, you know, it made very much sense why these two things were very connected, but I'm sure somebody along the line might have gone, well, I don't really follow, I don't see how these are connected, I don't know how you can get something out of it. Did you ever find that? Or were people as enthusiastic as you were?
I'd say, like, at York, I have a fantastic supervisor, Dr. Sarah Perry, and she's been amazingly supportive and really kind of pushed me into it a bit. But I think outside of the discipline, people are certainly a bit like, no, games are for entertainment, whereas archaeology is for serious academic study, and never the two should cross. But coming to York, there's this fantastic culture of being like, no, these things are not in isolation. We need to actually look at these relationships and see how they impact on each other. So that's been fantastic, yeah.
So when was the first time you noticed this connection? I mean, was it playing something like, I don't know, Skyrim, playing something? Or, I mean, where did you see the archaeology? And where did it kind of go, ah, wait a minute, I see that now.
I think I've always been a little bit aware of, I mean, like, every game has a set which is dressed in particular ways, and you notice the kind of, like, environment cues and the things that tells you about that world. But definitely moving into things like the original Assassin's Creed, it became really explicit, and Skyrim, as you just mentioned. And I think that was a real turning point to me, that it's like, no, people want to put history and archaeology into games and do it in a very serious way. But, you know, whether that's done well is another question.
And I'm assuming that done well is it needs to be explored, because obviously, you know, can we be sure right now if we're doing well or not? I mean, do you think like, what kind of things are you looking for in an archaeological game or a game that uses archaeology?
Ooh, that's a really loaded question.
I know it is. And I mean, the thing is, obviously, for me personally, I've mentioned this before, that I feel that if you can take the game skins and you can skin them in a futuristic form,
yep,
and not have any of the mechanics change, then all you have is history as window dressing.
Yeah, exactly.
You know what I mean?
Yep.
And so for me, the archaeology, archaeological thing has to come in at a point where if you take the idea or the symbology of history away, your game changes innately. I don't know, what would you say about how an archaeological game would, what kind of do you look for?
I would agree with you totally on that point. I mean, it's one of the things that has really bugged me, I guess, a little bit about the sort of latest iterations of the Tomb Raider series, where it becomes less about her role as an archaeologist and more about, like, you could take her into space, you could put her wherever, and the story would still hold. And it's kind of like, you know, we have this sort of, like, tradition of using artifacts or using archaeology as sort of cheap mechanics to justify experience or to justify going to places or to justify getting money in a world. And I mean, this permeates all the way down through games, even to, like, really inane games like Animal Crossing New Leaf. And the treatment of archaeology is always as a monetary value, standalone objects which can be identified easily, which then get sold to progress the game. And I think that's a little bit problematic.
although in some ways, since a lot of our video culture and a lot of our media culture actually reflects the wider ideas in society, and I'm pretty sure I've seen some recent conversations on repatriation around the internet, that makes it seem as if the past is purely for monetary value, which I completely disagree with.
Yeah.
But I'm just saying, you know, the way currently our capitalist system kind of, it presents the past. It's always seen in terms of economic value or, you know, in some sort of capital way. So I think, you know, maybe that's just an extension of that.
Yeah. I mean, I think that there's more of a recursive relationship though in a way. It's if we continue to present these things in the media only in this way, it's hardly surprising that becomes the popular trend of how people consume or want to engage with that culture. So I think there's maybe a little bit of a duty of care for us to, you know, take interest in how these things are being presented and maybe think about how they could better be used.
Of course. And it's not about, you know, having every game that has some sort of historical, tiny little historical bit and saying, oh, no, this is wrong. It's about, you know, when there's a major component of history or the past in these games, that it's treated correctly.
Yeah, or at least treated in a way which prompts the player to investigate it or engage with it in a meaningful way. I think the worst thing that we do is trivializing the past or reducing it purely only to economics. There's nothing wrong with that, but it's just when that's the only thing you see, it's a bit problematic, yeah.
Yeah. So obviously you did your blog as part of your master's and you're moving on to a PhD. Can you tell us a little bit about what your PhD research is about?
Yeah, definitely. I've just got taken on in the Centre for Digital Heritage at the University of York, and I'm looking at 3D documentation practices, specifically with regards to video games. And a large sort of focus of that is looking at how we mediate the discussion and sort of like knowledge exchange between the disparate sort of parties, between the consumer of the game, the producers of the game, and us as critics or facilitators for the history of these games. Because whilst there's sort of been quite a lot of research into the presentation of history in games, there hasn't been a whole lot into how or why these things form in the way they do, or how we could better manage it going forward. So that's basically what my PhD is looking into.
Mm-hmm. And obviously you've got quite a lot of games that you're kind of looking at. I mean, do some certain games or certain kind of what we call genres of games lend themselves to having more archaeology, or have you found the way the past is represented across all different types of games?
I think that archaeology as a whole, or history as a whole, has sort of fallen into two kind of tropes, I guess, for want of a better word, that we tend to sort of fit archaeology into like action adventure games, like the Indiana Jones, those kind of sort of style Tomb Raiders of the world. And then we also take history or more modern history in the terms of war and stick it into FPS or strategy based genres, because I guess that's what we consider, you know, top-down warfare or in the trenches kind of thing. But I think that there have been games coming out more recently, you know, Never Alone, Gone Home, The Stanley Parable, these games which sort of like subvert these sort of ideas that we have about how the past can be represented and starts to do some more interesting things with it. So I don't think there's necessarily a genre which fits history or archaeology better. I just think that we've been a little bit, not lazy, but we've been a little bit sort of confined in our approach potentially until now.
So, I mean, obviously, certain games that do subvert what normally games do and subvert the norm, I think, personally, that's the only way you can demonstrate archaeology.
Yeah.
Because when you have a kind of what I like to call the theoretical tree, it's like you start off where you know where the site is, you do a site survey, you have one interpretation. You go in, dig a little, your interpretation grows, and as you dig up more, as you interpret at the trial's edge, you kind of grow this tree, and the tree will grow in several different ways, and ultimately the bark that was at the bottom may be completely different from the leaves at the top. And you're always having to remind yourself that, you know, what you are seeing is just an evolving form of, you know, what's going on. So for me, a game that kind of subverts the staticness of a game world, that says, actually, this is just an interpretation, and kind of can, you know, confuse, it can like throw, you know, new ideas in front of the player, new visuals in front of the player as they go along, I think is one of the ways we can show this change in interpretation. Am I just taking crazy pills?
No, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, it's not an explicitly archaeological game, but there was a game called Gone Home, which came out, and it was a sort of great experiment into environmental storytelling and kind of pulling these like really intricate strands of people's lives and ideas that surround them from within the context of a house, the artifacts and the sort of things which exist within that space. And I mean, it's been critiqued quite heavily as like, is this even a game? But from my point of view, it was incredible to engage with this world where you basically play an archaeologist, even though you're not at all an archaeologist in this game. But you find these incredible ideas and stories about these people's lives just simply from the remains that are scattered around the place. And you're constantly having to reevaluate what your impressions or thoughts or opinions of this place is. I think it's a really powerful thing and something that we could look into a bit more in this genre. Yeah.
And obviously, you know, when we're talking about these things, it's not explicitly to be archaeological. You know, we can, like, the way we look at this, ultimately, we want to enrich the entire game industry in the way we can represent stuff.
Yeah,
because absolutely. Archaeologists, at the end of the day, want to tell stories, and games want to tell stories. It's just that with archaeology, you have an idea that you are telling a story out of, well, what is a mess, you know? As they say, you know, the past is an undignified mess that you're trying to pick through. I mean, if it's midden piles, you're basically picking through someone's trash to work out how they lived. And I mean, if you kind of looked at that, you know, if somebody went through the bins outside my house, I don't know what they could say about me. there is a strong interpretive and theoretical analogy between how we create the worlds in video games and how we create the interpretations now. I mean, is that something that you've seen as well? Or how do you see the relation between theory and video games?
I think it's a really interesting question. As part of my master's, I did quite a bit of work going to game studios and looking at their practices of how they create both archaeological worlds and how they conduct their design process in general. And it's fascinating to kind of look at how they construct ideas about this world and construct these narratives about it and create these kind of great analogies to how we do it in the trenches, so to speak. But that's sort of where the analogy almost ends, because their story then becomes fixed and guided by these kind of quiet, stringent practices about how a video game could or should look and how it's going to be sold and how it's going to be marketed. Whereas as archaeologists, we still have this idea that we're trying to add to knowledge and trying to develop these stories as new evidence comes to light. And it's sort of a crossover which I guess all that dialogue has not really happened as to how these two things differ or could be integrated, so to speak.
So, which game studios do you go to? Like, which games did you get to see?
I saw quite a lot. I'm not really supposed to talk about most of them because of non-disclosure agreements. So I can talk about them like anonymous terms. But
I mean, was there anything that you noticed when you were going to these places of nondescript companies? And were there any things that you noticed across in general terms about what happened in the gaming industry? You know, when it came to how they viewed archaeology. I mean, personally, did they seem like they knew what was going on, or were they kind of, did they ask you questions? I mean, what sort of dialogue went on?
It's fascinating. It was really fascinating going to these places and being involved in their process. I mean, the first thing that really stands out is they always look for facts. There's this idea that written history is fact history. That's what happened in the past. And this idea that if we, like us as an archaeologist, if we look at an artifact, we can tell you definitively what that is, where it came from, and what it means. And like, I mean, us as archaeologists realize that, yes, I mean, like, you can kind of play around with that, but no, like, that's not how it works at all. I accompanied a couple of the studios as they went to talk to historians at universities, and watching the dialogue between them was fascinating because obviously the game studio doesn't speak history and the historian professor doesn't speak video games at all. And you just have this complete breakdown in dialogue. So you have the game studio asking, like, would the sandals have been purple? And the historian being like, why does that even matter? What is that question? What context is this in? At what point in time? Who? Which part of society? And it's like, there was just no idea about what the other was capable of or was trying to get at.
Mm-hmm. And obviously, that's not just a thing between archaeologists and video games. I mean, you know, you could say that that same kind of separation divide exists with archaeology in many different subjects.
Yeah, I think it's prominent, but especially like with film and TV as well. We've seen that.
Oh yeah, yeah. Yeah, we've seen terrible things.
Yeah.
but obviously one of the biggest video games to get mentioned, and still, for some reason, is still going, I'm sure I'm going to get flack for that, is Tomb Raider.
Yep.
And
yep.
Tomb Raider is interesting for a number of reasons. Number one being a female protagonist of video games back when the PS1 was released.
Yep.
And that was when the conversations about women in video games wasn't really being talked about. Number two, earlier iterations of Lara Croft's identity looked, I mean, like, I maybe I got this wrong, but she didn't look, she looked non-white as well, as a person of colour.
Yeah.
And maybe I'm going to get completely taken apart from that, but like, there were, she was a very, very non-standard character for a video game. And obviously, she's changed over the years. There have been different reinterpretations, but I want to know, what was, did you ever have a connection to Tomb Raider?
Well, initially, I started out as a computer science person, so when I played these games, I wasn't really attached to the archaeological side of them, but certainly identified with her as a character, like as a strong protagonist. But I think more recently, I've started to really identify with who she is and what she does. It's fascinating. She's a great role model in a lot of respects. Not so much in others, but in a lot of respects. She's very good.
But yeah, of course. I mean, the only thing is that nowadays the modern iterations of Tomb Raider have been about, well, you know, as you said, she could have been Space Raider.
Yeah.
You know, although isn't Space Raiders, isn't that type of crisps? Like, you know, those little, like, sure. 20 pence crisps that you can get, and they're like a pickled onion flavor.
Oh my gosh, you're making me hungry. Stop.
I swear, they're called Space Raiders. Oh, I'm going to have to remember that now. But anyway, obviously, you know, I don't know how much of the older Tomb Raider games you played, but I don't know if you remember if they were particularly, quote-unquote, archaeological.
I think that in the older ones especially, the archaeology would tend to be woven a bit more intricately into the storyline rather than simply being like, here's a quest to go find some tombs, sweet, you found them in the game. I found that very much in the 2013, there were some big problems with it's like, you roll in and you find a cache of artifacts that make no sense to the context, and it's never explained what you're doing there. And then sort of, you know, to add on top of it, there's the whole willful destruction of history to gain experience points when she destroys the cans. And I, from memory, that wasn't hugely prolific in the prequel to that. So it was almost taking a step backwards from an archaeological point of view.
Horrible. No, I can't imagine doing that. Oh, no, that's bad. That's bad. Oh, jeez. No, I mean, obviously, it's a development that may not be the best, but obviously you've been blogging about more recent games, so you're big, it seems like you're a bit of a fan of Shadow of Mordor.
Yeah.
a little bit of a fan.
Yeah. Big Tolkien fan, so.
Oh, right. Oh, well, no, of course. You lived in New Zealand for a while. I mean, come on. You had to be a Tolkien fan.
Hobbits, yeah.
I'm sure it's part of the citizenship. So, obviously, Shadow of Mordor, I haven't played it. I don't know what it's about. I have not a clue. But from reading, obviously, you can check out this blog article, which is Archaeology and Game, Middle-earth, Shadow of Mordor. So can you tell us a little bit about why you were interested in, why did Shadow of Mordor stand out for you rather than a different game?
When I started playing Shadow of Mordor, I wasn't overtly aware of any archaeological aspects to it. But the more I sort of progressed through, I was like, huh, they've actually done some interesting and quite novel things with how they've tried to represent the material culture of Middle-earth. And that sort of started to get me thinking about, well, what's different about the way that they've done it here versus other games, and what's good and bad, or how could these things be improved with some very simple sort of one or two lines more of text or one or two changes to the code. And that's sort of where I started this process of looking at it more seriously for Shadow of Mordor.
And what kind of things were you looking for in the game with regards, I mean, what were kind of some of the things that you started to pick out?
I think that the first thing that I noticed was that they don't treat archaeology as a pure economic reward. There's this like slightly cultural layer to how they deal with things. The second thing was that artifacts aren't always found pristine. They're not always found as a full artifact for, you know, resale at a higher price. And at the same stage, when they're found fragmented, it's not always just like it was thrown out from nowhere. There's a bit of a backstory as to how it became fragmented, which they try to sort of engage with. And then over and above that, there's this idea that there's these things called ithilden, which sort of act as enchainment symbols across the landscapes. Okay. And that to me was fascinating because I hadn't really come across that apart from in the Legend of Zelda series. So it's like, well, they're doing some new things with archaeology, and that's really exciting to me.
Obviously, I mean, obviously in other games, you have maybe, you know, there's a certain number of artifacts to get. You know, there's an idea that you have to, out of 100, you know, you have to collect a number. I mean, what about Shadow of Mordor in that respect? I mean, was there, these artifacts, were they part of a collection by the game, or was it just to collect, if you were, when you could? Or was there a kind of completion to it as well?
Yeah, they very much still fall into that completionist objective-based gaming kind of thing where it's like, you don't ever have to touch them, but if you want to complete the game 100%, you have to find them all. Which I think, again, like, you know, it's a bit problematic that you have this weird segregation of the story layer and then you have the kind of artifacts existing separate to that, but still somehow integrated. But the way that they integrated them was interesting. So if you do pursue them, do you pursue the artifact and the Ithilden, it's interesting.
No, that's good. I mean, obviously you don't want to give too much away for people who haven't already played it.
No.
But that's really good that we have a game that actually is maybe, you know, giving a little bit more thought to it. So obviously, archaeology is not just in games that are, well, I mean, you know, obviously Tolkien is fantasy, very much in the realm of fantasy, but archaeology can extend to other games. I don't know if you're familiar with the Fallout series. And
my
favorite being Fallout 3, currently playing Point Lookout because it's actually one of my favorite DLCs. I don't know why. I don't know why it's one of my favorite DLCs, but it's really, really good fun. But it's got a lot of what the Americans would call historical archaeology. I found out during a conversation that doesn't mean what I thought it meant. unfortunately, American archaeology only have a few hundred years, so anything before that's prehistory. Americans, still weird to me. But sorry.
Can identify being a New Zealander.
Oh,
we have the same situation.
Oh, damn it. Oh, sorry, I didn't mean to insult you. But obviously, particularly in Fallout, there's a lot of material that you can find and you can see around the world that gives you an idea about what the world of 2077 was like, you know, before the bombs dropped, without giving you explicit meaning. So, like, obviously the posters, the propaganda, the way the robots were programmed, and, I mean, for me, piecing all that information together, all those little tiny bits, and creating what you think of this world, that's archaeology. I mean, to me. But what do you think? What do you think about that?
I totally agree. I think that's one of the real draw cards to me of Fallout is this piecing together of this incredible world through what is essentially very mundane material culture. And you know, I mentioned Gone Home before, and that does a very similar thing, but in a different sort of a setting. I think it's definitely something, again, Skyrim kind of does it as well, that certain NPCs have rooms and setups and houses which tell the stories of them. So when you speak to them, you get one story. When you investigate their house, you get an entirely different story about who they are. But I think it relies on people being tuned in to that or being interested in it. It's quite hard to get people who aren't interested in that sort of historical setting or investigating that to realize that these things even exist in that world.
And of course, if you tried to direct that through gameplay, you'd just be creating the same issues as before. So I mean, well, I mean, then of course the game developer's going to go, well, what do you want me to do? What do I do? If I don't do it, you're going to complain. If I go and do it, you're going to complain. What do I do as a game developer? How do I make things archaeological? Sorry, I don't know where I was going with that. So how would game developers actually improve the situation if it's the problem we've just identified is there's something with the gamer themselves and their desire to explore.
Again, like it's I don't know if there's an easy answer to this because it's quite a loaded question.
Give me
not
the
really
answer. Just one sentence. One that's all I want to hear. Just give me the answer so I can then go and do something with it. I don't want a discussion. What do you think this is? This is a podcast. God damn it. No, go on. Go ahead.
I'm
go
sorry.
Ahead.
I think that, I know, like from the research that I've done and the games that I've played, it really relies a lot on a better engagement between the different disciplines, between talking to players and talking to people from history and archaeology and people from the games world as well, and coming to sort of more holistic or different ideas about how we can play with this. Because as I say, there's no one size fits all, and it's only really through playing around with a lot of these concepts that we'll get anywhere. But at the moment, we sort of run into a lot of glass walls and communication barriers, and they stop a lot of really interesting things being done. So I don't know if that answers the question. Probably raises more than it
answers. And that's the best thing about it being in academia.
Oh, yeah.
Because
exactly.
If you can't ask more questions, then you're going to have to give an answer. So, obviously, you come from a computer science background. So that means you do a bit of programming, right?
Yes, correct.
So, have you ever made a little small game?
I have. I've made a couple, actually. Before the whole move to archaeology, there was a few which were irrelevant, but recently...
Okay. Hey, I'm pretty recently. Sure they were just as relevant, they were just as awesome, okay? You know? So, obviously, have you then brought archaeology and gaming together yourself, as in putting, you know, money where your mouth is?
Yeah, I for the Heritage Jam held from York, I made a little text-based exploration kind of narrative game called Buried.
Oh, right, you made that.
Yeah, that was me.
That's really good. I love it. I really liked it. I didn't realize you'd made it. Oh, I should really research my guests more often. Better. Yeah, that's really cool. Sorry, explain for anybody who hasn't played the game what it's like.
So Buried is basically like it's the old text-based adventure type of game. This like choose your own adventure story. But it's about an archaeologist who sort of returned home from the field and is sort of grappling with these ideas of what burial can mean in its various different contexts and how it should be interpreted and talked about or internalized or externalized onto paper. So it's sort of the very real decisions that we go through as archaeologists and trying to put it in a way that anybody who's not an archaeologist can pick up the game and start to get an understanding that we don't just know everything about one artifact from its context. It can mean so many different things. So that was what that was about.
And it was an experiment. You said there was two games.
Yes. Recently, I went to a doctoral conference in Sweden, and for part of that, I made three games, actually. One in a similar vein to Buried, and one which was a more sort of like action side-scrolly shooty game, which was about the Great Emu Wars in Australia. And it was a sort of attempt to deal with usually when we have heritage that hurts, we kind of avert the problem. The Great Emu Wars is kind of the opposite to that. It's heritage that hurts for a group of people, but the rest of people in popular memory and popular culture, we think of it as this hysterical, you know, show of incompetency. It's really funny.
Like when you say the Emu Wars, I think I've heard of it before, but I'm just imagining, you know, a bunch of large flightless birds. Can you kind of bring me up to speed on what the Emu Wars were before I start upsetting people by laughing about these birds wearing helmets and like trying to fire weapons? So
no, you have covered off the popular memory of the event very well just then.
Okay. So obviously, oh damn it, I can't really be much of an archaeologist if I just go with what popular thing is. Damn it, you've showed me what a fool I am. Continue.
But the more realistic situation was that it was, you know, post First World War, post Great Depression, people were struggling in Western Australia, no food, no water, crops were failing, whole bunch of emus come in and start stirring stuff up again. And they're basically like, well, we can't keep living out here. So the government's like, oh, we'll jump in and we'll send some military out. We'll send a artillery division and we'll shoot a bunch of these emus. Failed miserably. They only ended up shooting 957 odd of some 57,000 emus. And these poor people were basically left to fend for themselves. And it was a really tragic sort of point in Australian history where what do you do? There's nothing you can do. You can't just hop down to the shop. There was no aid at the time, and these people were starving in the middle of nowhere. But we choose to remember the event as emus with guns and being quite funny. So the game, which I made, sort of tried to bridge these two and try to get people to think about what the reality of the situation was, or sort of try to subvert that these popular ideas that we have and play around with how we could represent history which hurts in video games.
And obviously, you know, yeah, history that hurts is very, very difficult because a lot of people see it as being trivialized in a video game.
Exactly.
Because ultimately, I mean, you know, ultimately the base of a game is a mechanic. You know, whether it's in a first-person shooter, it's a shooting mechanic, etc., etc., etc. You know, how can you then better involve a much more sensitive video game? I mean, obviously, everybody's going to say anyway, oh, well, you know, these are video games. Video games are games were for children. You know, this is not a proper art form, blah, 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 blah. I don't know what I'm talking about because I don't play them, but my little son plays them and he gets really angry. You know, how do we communicate that video games can be sensitive, video games can be, you know, a way of expressing? I mean, how do you see that happening?
I think we talk a little bit about this idea of like a media bias, that there are things which games are really good at. And as you rightly pointed out, it's like games are good at having mechanics. They're good at, you know, shooting things and making things exciting and being fun. And that's sort of what we traditionally associate with being a game. We sort of put this idea of play into there. But that's quite sort of culturally constructed in a way. So there are other things which games can do, and we need to sort of investigate those on their own merits, I guess.
What you mean in making a game boring?
Not at all. I mean, I think that there have been games like Zoe Quinn's Depression Quest. It's a game about people who suffer with depression. Mm-hmm. It's tried sort of like to get a window into the world of dealing with mental illness. And it's this fascinating thing where it sort of splits play and game and gives you this opportunity with games or with game mechanics which are not necessarily fun, but are important and meaningful. And when you finish the game, you feel like, wow, I've really experienced something, but it relies on mechanics which go against everything which we associate with what games are good at. So it's possible, but it relies a lot on going against the grain, so to speak.
This is brilliant to hear. I mean, this is what I mentioned to you know, Andrew Reinhardt. I've had him on the show several times, and I've mentioned that, you know, games, the problem with games is a lot of them are fun. And when you're trying to demonstrate an experience in the past, which may not have been fun, how do you do that but still remain engaging? So, you know, having different ways is absolutely fantastic. I'd love to hear about much more interesting and different ways of making things difficult but fun. Because I know, I've been playing Risk of Rain recently. And that is a difficult, difficult game. Or maybe I'm just really bad at it. And actually, you know, like I'm thinking to myself, actually, you know, it's quite interesting. That's got a lot of artifacts and stuff in it, but it's not particularly archaeological, but it's really good fun. But it's challenging, but I always feel that, you know, the challenge is, when I lose, it's only because it's my fault. And obviously that's one way of you know, giving the player a set of tools and allowing them run free would be great. I mean, what would you like to do? Would you be looking at one point making some sort of a 3D reconstruction of the past that people can explore? Would you be looking at, you know, making games that are archaeologically accurate? Or, you know, what's your kind of, what would you like to do past your PhD?
I've toyed around with this idea of making reconstructions and kind of delving into that. And I think it's almost a bit of a trap for video games in a way. Because when you start to get into this thing again of what I present to you as fat, and I think Assassin's Creed leans on this a lot as like a marketing strategy, which is like, we created Paris as it was during the French Revolution. It's historically accurate, therefore our game is better. And it's kind of like, well, yes and no in a lot of ways.
I'd like to challenge that. I don't know. Right. I don't know. Okay, I don't know. Have you played Assassin's Creed 4, Black Flag?
Yes.
You know the start. Do you know the just after the start sequence when they, the person you basically you find yourself. Oh, I'm in the Animus, and the woman tells you that Abstergo is obviously okay. This is spoilers for anybody who hasn't played the first 10 minutes of Assassin's Creed Black Flag. So you switch off and. Yeah, okay, so basically she explains Abstergo is an entertainment company, and what they do is they use the memory link for people to detail the long-form history, and what they do is they give people historical experiences in the short form, you know?
Yeah.
And which aren't as interactive. So, and it's purely for entertainment, and they realize that they've created these snippets of small entertainment for people. So actually, I think it's more other people saying, oh, look, Ubisoft has created the French Revolution as it was. Rather than, I think, unless they're really, really oblivious to understanding their role, I think actually maybe they do understand that they created a form of it which is in shorthand and, you know, is playable only because they've made it like that. I mean, maybe... I'm giving them too much credit here. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, to add to that a little bit, again, spoilers for anyone who hasn't played, but there's a great unlockable sequence of emails in Black Flag, which is this great argument between the development leads in the studio, where they're basically discussing where they should take the next historical snippet, so to speak. And one of the guys is saying, like, we should go into the really important parts of history so people can experience and see those. And another guy is going, no, that's really boring because there are no zombies or witch doctors or, you know, we need excitement, we need war, we need these things to fuel it. And it's kind of like a reflection of, I guess, what happens in the studios, where it's like, we could go for complete accuracy for telling a narrative, or we could go for the exciting parts of history and get people to engage or enjoy those that way. It was an interesting insight, but I don't know, I'm still a little bit on the fence, because in all the marketing material from Ubisoft, they do talk about how they put so much, like, you know, effort into recreating Paris in the past or Florence in the past.
I mean, I think it would probably be better if they said representing Florence in the past or Paris.
But even then,
it's
just the buildings. It's, I mean, like, Unity, they've attempted to do some really interesting stuff with the crowds, but still it's like very much like artifact and architectural based idea about what the past was, rather than engaging with the less visible things.
Oh no, of course. And I think for me, the past is definitely something you have to engage with. So just by recreating, you know, this, I mean, I'm currently playing through Assassin's Creed 2 and 4 at the same time. I don't know why I did that. But, and I, you know, to me, it isn't, it, you know, although it's absolutely splendorific to see these wonderful ancient cities, I enjoyed playing. I enjoy the architecture. I think it's great and everything. But it is when you interact with these cities, I think, is the archaeology, as it were. You know, it's when you go around and see people do stuff. It's when you go around and see things happening in the city rather than just the city itself, which is archaeology. And so, you know, games like, I mean, not historical or in any way, but, you know, Grand Theft Auto having things happening on the street as you go by, or these little stories that you find when things happen in video games, those are kind of archaeology, as it were. But I mean, you know, Assassin's Creed has got the separation of saying, look, this is a recreated history from genetic memory, whatever that is, unobtainium, and, you know, you've still got that you're vicariously experiencing through the character who's experiencing through the second character. And I think that relational sequence is really what's great about Assassin's Creed, whether, you know, whether there's a lot of other issues with how they talk about it, at least they've got that set up really well. And I think that allows the person to see basically, well, actually, you know, this isn't as it happened, but this is kind of in step with what it should, you know, like the kind of things that were going on.
Yeah. I think one of the really interesting things that I came across doing my master's research was that the players of these games really enjoyed that, but the thing which they felt was missing was they wanted to know where the interpretation process came from. So they wanted to know why things were presented the way that they were, or why they made particular design decisions. So they weren't so concerned about, like, you know, whether it was accurate or authentic. They just wanted to know why and where that comes from. And that's something I think that games haven't really catered to so much already. Yeah. You know, like Assassin's Creed has, they have like the artifact log, but it doesn't tell you how they made that interpretation or where it came from. It just says this is what it is.
I'm going to throw a really crazy thing your way. I don't want, like, this is off the bat. I haven't you know, said anything about this. I just had something great idea. I don't know if you've seen recently Halo the Anniversary Edition. And obviously all the Halo games, the first two, what you can do is you can switch through the new engine or you swap to the old engine. I don't know if you've seen that.
Yeah.
So you've got these two engines running side by side, blah, blah, blah. Wouldn't it be cool if a game like Assassin's Creed had this switching, but the switching was between the game world and the sites that were visited? So what you'd have is you'd press the button and obviously it would swap to the trenches. You know, it'd swap to the kind of artifacts that you have, or it'll swap to a modern day kind of version so that you can see, you know, what the difference between what you get in the ground and between what is made there. I don't know, does that sound interesting, or am I getting really, am I just spinning my wheels here?
You've just spoiled the game which I'm working on at the moment called Perspectives of the Past, which does exactly what you're saying. It has two layers which sit in tandem with each other. And it's a puzzle platformer. And it's basically like you have the world which sits there now, the ruins, the kind of context that you don't associate with the past. And then behind that, when you switch your view, it goes to the context which these things were used in live. And you have to figure out how to flick between the two of those to create the story and create your path through this world. So there we go, announcement. There we go.
I just thought of it now. God, I think I know if I was going to do a master's which direction I'm going to go in. So obviously there you got another game going. That's completely derailed my train here. I'm really, really sorry about that. I hope you weren't trying to announce it anytime soon.
No.
Well, that's really, really interesting. I mean, are you going to? I mean, obviously, it's going to probably take a wee bit of time to do the project. I mean, are you hoping to release it by the end of the year, or are we looking for next year to actually kind of see it?
It's kind of one of these like side projects that I've been working on for about 3 months, and I have no idea when I'll finish it. But hopefully. Hopefully I'll get time next year to do a little bit of work on it.
Okay. No, of course. And we'll be waiting. We'll be waiting very patiently. Because, you know, you heard it first here on the Anarchaeologist podcast. That's what's happening here. Obviously, you know, what you study and what you're looking into has, you know, it's very much part of what I've experienced about the kind of like online archaeology media. I mean, do you find, I mean, obviously you're on Twitter and you're on a few other websites. I mean, how do you feel that other people who are archaeologists and use Twitter, how have they kind of responded to the work you do? What are your conversations with them like?
I think overall it's been really, really positive. I've met some amazing people like Andrew that you mentioned before, Sarah, Colleen, Sean. Like there are some amazing people on Twitter who are really engaging, I guess, with the work which they're doing and also with the work which I do. It's an amazing community. Yeah.
Do you think that a certain type of person uses Twitter and looks at archaeology and video games as being a thing, or do you think it's a lot more spread?
I think it's slowly gaining acceptance. I mean, like the latest ESAs were pretty condemning, or pretty, I guess not condemning, but pretty exciting in this, exciting in the sense that video games have overtaken every other form of media in terms of sales and popularity. Mm-hmm. And I think it sort of put a stake in the ground which says these things need to be taken seriously, and we need to actually care about them. And as academics, rather than just letting it wash by us, we should actually engage with it. And I think there's more and more of a community starting to come together and understand and pursue that.
Brilliant. And obviously video games, you're playing video games. What are you playing at the moment then?
I have a terrible video game addiction. I play a lot of competitive games, but sort of archaeology-based games that I'm playing at the moment is Never Alone. It's incredible. And also This War of Mine. Two great games that have just come out.
What about non-archaeology games?
Non-archaeology games? I commit a lot of time to Dota 2 and TF2.
Seriously? Oh my god, that's really cool. I mean, I tried to play Dota 2. A friend of mine's really, really into it, and he's tried to guide me through, but I'm not very good at the MOBA titles. I think those are, I can't remember what they're called, and like League of Legends as well, and doesn't work with me. I'm very much into kind of like RTS and FPS. Those are my mainstays, and I love them dearly. But that's really, really cool. I'm gonna have to add you on Steam sometime. We should do. I've suggested this actually to one of the other the guy who runs the Archeo Soup YouTube channel. We should do some online gaming against each other. I mean, would you be up for archaeologist versus the archaeologist?
Definitely, let's do it. Sounds like a plan.
Oh, good. I'll you know what, if I manage to then completely destroy you, I'll bury you with a few of your best artifacts, and somebody else can dig you up in a wee while. That's how you trash talk with archaeologists. Just tell them that you're going to give a terrible burial context, and they go crazy. Oh my god, no, you can't do that. Somebody might think I'm an anthropologist. I'm being mean now. All right. Well, thank you very, very much for coming and speaking to me. And I hope this is really good for you, because I really enjoyed this. It's been really absolutely fantastic to speak to someone like you who has really cool interests.
No, it's been a pleasure. I've really enjoyed it.
And if anybody wants to follow in the work you do, any of the blogs, where can they go?
Either to my Twitter, which is @gamingarchio, or to my blog, which is blog.tarakopplestone.co.uk, I think. That sounds right.
Yes, .co.uk. Oh, dear. Well, anyway, I'll put the links to that in the show notes. Thank you very, very much. And catch the Anarchaeologist podcast again in 2 weeks. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the Anarchaeologist podcast. The Anarchaeologist podcast is going to be migrating to the Archaeology Podcast Network, which goes live on the 1st of December. You can find that at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. You'll find all the new shows and some of the backlogs of these shows as well over there. So go and check it out from the 1st of December.